Chapter 7, A New Life. Having obtained a place at the training college was like going back to school again, except that I was now in the company of much younger people, mostly school teachers and university graduates, plus a few professionally trained folk making a change in direction, as I was. It was quite a refreshing experience, which I enjoyed very much, and being the oldest on the course earned me some distinction, for it was announced by the course tutor one morning that Mr. Richardson has become the first grandfather we have ever had. Well, my son Paul and his wife Elizabeth had their first child. I found it good fun rushing home to tell Ingrid that I had achieved an A- in economics or a B+ in psychology or whatever, and the exercise of the mind in new ways and fresh subjects was no bad thing. My experience may be helpful to others in one respect, for it could be an encouragement to any who feel trapped in middle life, in a job which they feel is not the right one for them, to make what I call my bid for freedom. We are sometimes paralyzed by fear of change, especially when we have family responsibilities. But so long as one is prepared to face a cutback in salary and living standards, there is no need to be afraid. With the Lord's help, we have still had 3 meals a day and been able to enjoy many of the blessings He allows us in this life, and at the same time engage in an occupation which was less cutthroat and more satisfying. In my case, I left the change until the last of my 3 children had gone off to college, and I had the full support of my partner, which is very important. Given these sensible precautions, there is no reason why any brother need fear to make a change. I call it backpedalling on life. And we discovered that it is quite possible to live satisfactorily on a reduced salary. Most of us live up to whatever income we have anyway. Another interesting outcome of the year at college was the opportunity it afforded to discuss religion with younger and sharper intelligences, and I had many openings to tell them what Christadelphians were. It is a rather sad reflection on our public witnessing that when one enters a new environment and meets new people, they never seem to have even heard of Christadelphians. It all seems to happen in hospital in just the same way. Religion, asked the nurse. Christadelphian, you say. How do you spell it, she replies. That's a new one to me. It cannot be, surely, that they have really never seen the word, but it is clear that it has made no impact. The impact only comes when they actually meet one, and I am convinced that it is only by this personal impact that we can make any impression. It is a living word and needs to be seen in living beings. The Word was made flesh in the Lord Jesus, in whom the life of the Father was seen moving about among men. In so far as this Word dwells in us, and is allowed to show itself in us, it becomes incarnate in the believer, and men see not an abstraction, but a living example of the believer in word and conversation and godliness. Not the word Christadelphian on a poster or in a handbill, which they forget, but a living person who is a Christadelphian, which they remember. The big question we have to ask ourselves then is, what do they see? And what do they remember? What a joy it is occasionally, when mentioning our name to a new acquaintance, to hear them say, Christadelphian, oh, I knew one once, I worked with one once, I lived next door to one once, and he was a fine man. That Christadelphian had done his job. While on the course in Kent, we belonged to the Dartford meeting, where I had been to Sunday school as a small boy, and we had a flat in the home of Brother Hubert Thornillow, whose wife Lily had recently died, leaving him a lonely man. I hope we were able to fill a gap in his life for the year following his loss. He was a brother I had known for many years, his family emanating from Northampton, and indeed he had been to the same school there as I, though many years before me, and had won a scholarship to Cambridge, ending up as an industrial chemist and one of the greatest authorities in the country on cement constructions. He is a good example to me of a rather strange phenomenon in our community. That is, that we think we have lots of friends in the truth, because we shake a lot of hands on Sundays or at the various gatherings, when in fact they are really only acquaintances. We do not know them. If anybody had asked me if I knew Hubert Thornillow, I should have replied that I knew him very well, and had done so for 20 years or more. But I didn't. I got to know him by living in the same house with him. And what a revelation he was. I had only known the outside of the man before. Now I found such hidden depth and gentle strength as I never knew were there. We loved him, and still do. As I write, he is a sick, elderly gentleman, having done great work in the Bible mission field in Mauritius, which he pioneered. We thank God for that year of loving companionship with a good man, which enabled both Ingrid, who did not really know him before, and I, who thought I did, to find out what he was really like. Having completed the course successfully, I obtained my first post as careers advisor in Basingstoke, a small town in Hampshire, which had once been a sleepy market town, but was now being developed as a London overspill area, with large industrial sites and sprawling housing estates. The nearest meetings were at Reading and Newbury, both around 16 or 17 miles away, and there were no Christadelphians in Basingstoke itself. There was an elderly couple of staunch members of the Newbury Ecclesia about 3 miles out of Basingstoke, with whom we became very close, and were later able to help with transport to meetings. Brother and Sister Alf Holiday had lived previously at Erith in Kent, where there had been severe flooding in which their own home had been partly submerged by the overflowing Thames, an experience which they never forgot, and led them to speak of events in their life as before the flood or after the flood, much to our amusement. When Brother Alf died a year or two after we arrived, his wife Florrie asked me to conduct the funeral, but wanted him buried in the local village churchyard so that she could more easily tend his grave. I telephoned the vicar to ask if this would be possible, which he agreed, in spite of it being a Christadelphian, but then had to tell him that the widow wanted me to conduct the service, and would this be acceptable to him. "Oh yes," came the reply, "there's no difficulty about that, as long as you realise that the fees will belong to me." I assured him on this point, and in fact he attended the burial service in his own church and was most helpful. In my talk I mentioned the fact that our brother went every Sunday to our services in Newbury, right up to his final illness, and the vicar was most impressed about this. He said to me afterwards, "Do you mean to say he went right into Newbury every Sunday? Why, I can't get my people to come round the corner to hear." Soon after we went to Basingstoke, I had a letter from my friend Fred Soaf asking us to make contact with an old brother who lived 7 miles out and was out of fellowship, though he received exhortations, etc., from the Isolation League. His name was Brother Colin Cosier, and we were very soon going out to visit him. In doing so, we were introduced to one who could very well be described as the most unforgettable character I have met. He was delightful in manners, with a cultivated mind, and a wonderful faith in God. His concern for the scriptures was quite extraordinary, and he reminded us of one of the old patriarchs. His great delight was the study of the word, and he wrote several very long articles, more properly small books, on various biblical subjects, which he gave me to read at different times. He was then about 80 years of age, and had been disfellowshipped at Coventry the same year that I was born, in 1916, because he believed in immortal emergence. He sadly wanted to be allowed into the fellowship of the body of Christ, but although we tried to arrange for his re-fellowship at Reading, the old prejudices and antagonisms eventually won the day, and he was refused. We fetched him most Sundays to attend the lecture meetings at Newbury, and he was a brother in Christ indeed, yet unable to remember the Lord with us in the appointed way, because of some theological quirk of understanding, and because he took too literally the words of Paul, "The dead shall be raised incorruptible." I wonder what Jesus thinks of it all. That our devotion to the intricacies of biblical exposition can be so heartless as to keep a man frozen out of our fellowship for 50 years, a man whose one desire is to die in the bosom of the Ecclesia, savours too much of the Pharisees for comfort. He's dead now, and we never let him in from the cold. The only consolation I have is that we were able to give him some warmth and Christian love for those few years, and let him know that we, at any rate, esteemed him highly in love for his work's sake, regardless of whether he believed in immortal emergence. The irony is that I know of brethren in fellowship who hold the same belief on this matter, including one of our best-known speakers who informed me before his death that this was his personal view. Why do we find leniency in our hearts for any kind of moral lapses, but think that an inability to understand all the complexities of doctrine must forever exclude from our fellowship? We lived in Basingstoke for 5 years, and being on our own there, we tried to hold meetings at least once every year, usually in the town hall, lasting for 4 weeks each time. We also had a full-scale Bible campaign in conjunction with the Newbury Ecclesia. We had been warned that it had not proved a fruitful area in the past, but felt it our duty to do what we could to witness, as we were virtually on our own there. The only convert we made was a sister whose mother had been on our list of glad tidings recipients, and when we wrote to ask if she would like us to read the Bible with her, she accepted and eventually became a member of Newbury Meeting. She had belonged to one of the more fashionable churches in Basingstoke, and we were a little apprehensive of taking her to our little meeting at Newbury, which met at that time in an auctioneer's room by the bus station, which will be remembered by many who visited it. It was a most unprepossessing place for worship, and we often had to sweep up cigarette ends and tidy up the room before we could hold our Sunday meetings. So we felt our new contact would compare it very unfavourably with the lovely church to which she was accustomed. But she took to it immediately, and told us later that it was the warmth of love which she had found so attractive, not only from the older members, but, what amazed her more, from even the young people who all spoke to me. This is as it should be, of course, for by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one toward another. So our only convert in Basingstoke came not through our public efforts, but as a result of first house meetings to read the Bible together, and then the friendliness of the brethren and sisters when we got out of the meetings. The understanding of the doctrines came later. Is there something to be learned from this? We had other contacts also, some of whom we had hoped would accept the truth, but none did. One was a very attractive young married girl with whom we had talked over a long period, who actually got to the point of having an interview, which was very satisfactory, and preparations were made for her baptism. But she cried off at the last minute because her husband realised it would make serious changes in their home life. He had not demurred when we went to their home for talks, and had actually agreed to come to her baptism, his only fear being that they won't do me as well, will they? But at the last minute they panicked at what it would do to their marriage, and she asked for a postponement, first of all, and then it was all cooled off. We were very sad, but Jesus did advise would-be disciples to sit down first and count the cost, and they were not willing to pay. There was an amusing episode when this young lady went to the meeting at Newbury for the very first time. We were not there, as I was speaking elsewhere, but we assured her she would be made very welcome. When we visited her afterward, we asked her how she got on, to which she replied that she had enjoyed the meeting, but had been quite taken by surprise as she entered, to be greeted by a big fellow who gave me a kiss. We assured her that this was not usual at Christadelphian meetings, but could see what had happened. A brother had taken her to be a sister from another ecclesia, and welcomed her in the warmth of brotherly kindness. She was not in the least offended, taking it to be our normal behaviour. But I had a word with the brother later, as he was a comparatively new member, and explained that it might be as well to ascertain first if the lady was one of us or not. He explained in defence of his action that Paul exhorted us to greet one another with a holy kiss, though I pointed out to him that he had never kissed me. There was no answer to that. But he meant well. Our preaching efforts in Basingstoke at least made the name Christadelphian known. We cannot always measure the effects of our witness in the number of converts, for there is a wider aspect to our work. Ye are the salt of the earth, said our Lord, and as grains of salt in an alien environment, we have the responsibility of trying to influence our little bit of the world with the ideas and the ideals of Jesus Christ, which alone can save it from putrefaction. So it was a great delight to me on one occasion, when we were holding some lectures in the town hall there, to learn that a carload of supporters from the Reading Ecclesia had come away without noting the address of the meetings. It was a dark winter's night, and as they entered Basingstoke they realised that they had no idea where to go, so stopped and asked somebody if they could tell them where the Christadelphians were having their meeting. The stranger replied, apparently, "Oh, you mean Mr. Richardson's meeting? It's in the town hall." It was heartening to know that to a total stranger in the dark, Richardson and Christadelphian were synonymous terms. When they told me later about this, I felt a little like Gideon must have felt when he heard the Midianite soldiers talking about him in Judges chapter 7:13, as he lay on his belly listening outside their tents in the dead of night, and when he heard it, he worshipped, the record says. What a simple statement, yet how profound. He worshipped. He didn't need to be in a place of worship or a posture of prayer. There he was, with Führer, his servant, doing a nighttime reconnaissance, eavesdropping on the enemy. But what he heard made him so thankful that he worshipped. Thank you, Lord, for letting me hear such encouraging news from the very camp of the enemy. Our Bible campaign led to a less pleasing incident in which the flesh was sorely tried, and we had a slight taste of the opprobrium which Jesus had to endure in such larger measure. It happened like this. As a result of the publicity for the campaign, the local newspaper sent a reporter to interview me regarding the Christadelphian Church, who spent about 2 hours at our home making copious notes and appearing to be attentive and sympathetic. Imagine our dismay, then, when the report appeared in the newspaper with a large headline reading, "Basingstoke Man Hopes to See the End of the World." There followed a garbled and biased account of some of our beliefs, notably the event leading up to Armageddon, with the statement, quite untrue, that Mr. Richardson believes that only he and his friends will survive, and ending with the fatuous comment that he settled back in his armchair, prepared for and waiting for the end. It gave the impression of a cranky sect, like some of those reported from America who gather up their belongings and sit on a mountainside expecting Christ to come on a particular day. I wrote to the editor to complain of being misrepresented and insisted that he should allow me to put in a proper account of what we stood for, as otherwise I would have to take other steps to clear my good name in the town, for I held a public office as an advisor in schools and was therefore vulnerable. He accepted this, and I had a long piece in the next week refuting the false report. But the damage had been done and the matter was not ended, for my boss in Winchester phoned me in the week to ask for a copy of the offending article, as he had received a letter from the Education Minister's Department in London about it. Somebody had made a complaint against me on the basis of this report, alleging that such a man should not be in a position to influence the young people, and they wanted an investigation. I sent the report, together with my own reply, to Winchester, and after reading it he came to see me about it. Fortunately, the county boss was a member of the Brethren and was most understanding. He said he shared my own views about prophecy and the Lord's coming, and we had an interesting conversation about it. He did a lot of preaching for the Brethren, and said he often spoke on prophecy, and could easily have said the same things and been equally misrepresented. So he made his report to London, which he was kind enough to read over the phone to me first, and we heard no more of it from there. But it was a very uncomfortable thing to happen, and we felt somewhat humiliated in the eyes of neighbours and colleagues, though the latter were very sympathetic and knew me better than to believe what they read in the newspaper. One small incident sticks in the mind about it. I was in the front garden of my home during the week, when a little man I'd never seen before came across to me and said, "Was I Mr. Richardson?" I really felt inclined to disown the fact, but on confessing that indeed I was, he said he just wanted to shake my hand and let me know I was not alone. "I believe the same as you do about this," he said, "although I am a Baptist and I shall not be able to come to your meetings, but I felt I would like to shake you by the hand." I found it quite comforting and still remember him kindly for it. A little later in the same week, I had another phone call from a journalist attached to the Reading newspaper. He had seen the Basingstoke article and wanted to do his own story. I told him that having suffered from misrepresentation once, I had no intention of being caught again. He, however, having read the article in question, was quite appalled at it and stated that he would be able to put the matter straight if I allowed him an interview. So I clutched at the straw, and he came and took his notes. When his piece appeared, however, the heading was, He's the only one. This article gave a reasonable account of the Christadelphian faith, how we began and some of our beliefs, but made the astounding discovery that Mr. Richardson and his wife are the only Christadelphians in the whole of Basingstoke, as though we were some local freaks. The lesson we learned from all this, though we should have known it, was that you need to be very careful in dealing with the media. It is nice, of course, to get publicity for our efforts, but it can be a two-edged weapon. What they think makes a story is very different to what we want them to publish. It is the old adage of one of the famous newspaper proprietors that dog bites man is not news, but man bites dog is. The campaign was a happy experience, and we enjoyed the company of a good number of enthusiastic young brethren and sisters. At the time, we had a young man coming to our house and attending the meetings in Newbury, who had been a Jehovah's Witness, and the company of the young campaigners so enthused him that he later was baptized. Unfortunately, he did not stay the course, and left us after a few years somewhere in the north of England. The circumstances of our finding him are quite interesting. He came to our house with a friend canvassing for the Jehovah's Witnesses while they were on holiday from college. They were both training to be teachers. We asked them in and had a long talk on the usual topics, involving the devil being cast out of heaven in Revelation chapter 12. We invited them to come again, though with little hope of making any impression on them, for they were very devout Jehovah's Witnesses, and Malcolm, with whom we were later to become so involved, appeared to be very adverse, and even refused to join in prayer before we started the discussion, considering us to be unbelievers. He did not come back, though his friend did, and we had quite high hopes of him. He later borrowed my Life and Works of John Thomas, but has disappeared from our view, and my book with him. They both went back to college in Portsmouth, and we felt we had probably seen the last of them. During the Easter holidays, however, there came a knock on the door one evening, and there stood the young man Malcolm. Could he come in and have another talk? He said one of the things the Jehovah's Witnesses advanced as proof of their religion was that they alone could explain the Book of Revelation, but he had realized in discussing it with me that you knew a lot more about it than I did. So in he came, and off we went, and in a very short time he spent nearly all his spare time each holiday at our house, reading and discussing the Bible. He so much enjoyed doing the daily readings with us. It's like having a Bible class every evening, he used to say. He was an intelligent and willing learner, who spent so much time with us that his father came round to order me to leave him alone, as he was becoming imbued with Christadelphian teachings. I had to point out that he was old enough to be able to decide such matters for himself, but he was so angry that I think if I'd not been a big fellow, he might have struck me. It was not long after the campaign that I had a phone call one evening from my old friend Fred Sove at Portsmouth to say he had had a visit from Malcolm, who wanted to borrow the 3 volumes of Eureka. I had given him Fred's address, knowing that he would be helped and encouraged there. Such is the confidence we can have in some brethren. Though I little expected that he would be round there quite so immediately, I recall the amazed comment of Brother Fred, "That young man certainly believes in jumping in at the deep end." A little later, he and his girlfriend were both baptized at Portsmouth, to our great joy. It is sad to think that neither are any longer members, but it is interesting to recall that it all started off from our understanding something about the apocalypse. I have sometimes thought that we do not credit others with an interest in these more difficult books and tend to assume that we alone are interested in them. how wrong we may be. In connection with my job as a careers advisor, I occasionally had to attend meetings of social workers from different disciplines at which various speakers gave talks on their particular type of work. On one such occasion, the speaker was a young Anglican parson whose talk was intriguingly entitled, Going In With The Milk. He had been given the task of starting up a new church on one of the large housing estates recently established by the Basingstoke Development Corporation, and was told that when he had got a congregation, the church commissioners would build him a church. In the meantime, he was housed in a large caravan, which served as a church for services, and also as a Sunday school. He began by getting together a small band of dedicated helpers and holding Bible study and prayer meetings in their homes, arranging as far as possible to have one such house meeting in each square. The development of the council houses was based on squares of homes grouped round a central green. It became then the responsibility of the leader in each area to watch for new arrivals, and as soon as someone was seen to be moving into a new house on the estate, they would knock on the door and introduce themselves in a friendly way, asking if there was any way in which they could help the newcomers to settle in. Information about local services, bus times, schools, library, etc., are often helpful in such circumstances, and thus a contact was made from which to go on to invite the newcomer to their Bible study group and later to take part in the work of the church and become themselves eyes and ears to contact and help others. That was why he called it Going In With The Milk, because milkmen and other tradesmen are well known to adopt this method of offering their service when new people are seen to be moving in. He considered that the church should be as on the ball as the milkman, and surely he was right. At the time he gave his talk, he had got together a weekly congregation of around 60, and after we left Basingstoke we learned that he had achieved the target set and the Church of England had built the promised church. I admired that young parson for his enterprise and zeal. Unless you should think him a paid hireling who was making a good thing out of his religion, a quite customary and ill-informed attitude among Christadelphians, I fear. I should add that when giving out our own handbills on one occasion, I came across his home with the vicarage on the gate. It was, in fact, a small council house, exactly like hundreds of others on the estate, and I wondered how many of those who condemn the clergy for accepting wages for their work live in such modest homes themselves. My experience is that the number is very small. Our customary attitude to a paid ministry has no basis in Scripture, for Paul has laid it down that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 14, etc. We may charge that the clergy do not preach the gospel, but that they receive their livelihood from those to whom they minister is perfectly scriptural. The fact that we prefer to have an unpaid ministry is the collective wisdom of the community, having seen the evil effects that can result from the introduction of money rewards into religion. In these days, however, it is a fact that most parsons could make more money in secular employments than they are paid as ministers of religion, and we should be very careful in making wild assertions about the paid hirelings of the church. In the case in point, I hang my head in shame that this young man established a church in a council estate while we only made 2 converts in 5 years in the same town. The other thing of particular interest in our Basingstoke days was the gospel rally, which was organised by the Newbury Ecclesia shortly before we left. It arose out of an Iranian Brethren's meeting, at which the discussion centred on what we could do by way of a preaching effort of a different kind. At that time, marches were the order of the day for promoting any cause, and I had a conversation with a teacher in one of my schools about this then new phenomenon. He was a communist intellectual agitator, very unpopular with his headmaster, but we had discussed religion on several occasions without coming to blows. He made a comment which had stuck in my mind. "You can't make any impression these days without going into the streets," he said. "You've got to get out and demonstrate." I suggested to the arranging brethren that we might have a go ourselves and try to organise a march through Newbury, calling on the populace to return to God in the expectation of the return of the Lord. The idea caught on and fired the enthusiasm of the small meeting to a degree which I have seldom, if ever, seen before or since. Unfortunately, however, the police authorities were unwilling to allow a public demonstration in the centre of Newbury on the Saturday we had requested, but said we could have it in Thatcham, which is a large village about 3 miles out of the centre. We settled for this and booked a very large marquee to be erected on the village green, the village hall for a mini-exhibition, and every member of the ecclesia got involved in some way in the preparations. There were posters to prepare, leaflets to be stamped, sandwich boards to be made, loudspeaker apparatus to be obtained, and all the other things usually associated with Bible campaigns. Even our elderly sisters took part in some aspect or other in the preparations. This was to be something bigger than anything we had before attempted. It was more than just another campaign, it was a gospel rally to which we invited ecclesias far and near to come and join in. At one stage in our preparation, it became apparent that we were not going to have enough money for all the things we wanted to do, and I had to report to the arranging brethren that we would have to curtail our ambitions somewhat. This was quite a blow, as the whole Newbury Ecclesia was behind the effort and had already given generously to pay for it. That night I went home to Basingstoke somewhat downcast, to think that our plan should be frustrated for want of money. But the telephone rang that same evening, and a brother from another meeting was on the line to say he had heard on the grapevine that we were doing something unusual and would like to give us some financial help. Like Nehemiah, I felt this was more than just chance, and told him how we were placed and what had taken place at our planning meeting. "How much do you need?" he asked. "I can give you £200 now and more if you need it." Remembering that £200 was a lot of money in those days, you may understand why I felt quite overwhelmed, and thanked God and took courage. It was more than enough to keep our plans and finances on an even keel, and we were so grateful to the Lord who had put it into our brother's heart to make such a generous and spontaneous offer just when we needed it. But why did it happen? And how did he come to ring me at the very moment when our plans were being embarrassed for lack of money? Needless to say, I very soon rang round to my colleagues to let them know the good news, and Brother Nelson Ball, known to many for his kind heart, but not noted for his extravagance of expression, told me afterwards that when I told him the good news on the telephone, he went cold. I know what he meant. There are not many times in life when you feel the almost physical presence of God. When the great day arrived for the gospel rally to take place, it was wet, not just a damp morning, but a thoroughly soaking day. After all our preparations, we were to be met with, quite literally, a wet blanket. Nevertheless, we were committed and began to assemble in the marquee to take out the leaflets, man the exhibition, and join in the procession, carrying banners on poles with Christadelphian slogans. To our joy, we were joined in the work by up to 200 brethren and sisters from many other places, as far afield as South Wales and the Midlands. It really was a rally of gospel preachers, and heartening in the extreme. And as the weather slowly improved, the spirits rose, and the occasion became one which remains in the mind of those who participated. In fact, when visiting the ecclesias in South Africa, 6 years after, we were confronted by a brother and sister in Port Elizabeth, who greeted us with, "How did the gospel rally finish up?" It appears that they had been present among the 200 helpers before emigrating to South Africa. They actually called it somewhat irreverently, Lens Dem. It will be pleasing to relate that the effort was a roaring success, but in truth the number of visitors to the meeting in the marquee in the evening was very poor, though we had a very good response from the children of Thatcham, who not only took part in the competition in connection with the Bible exhibition, but actually begged us to start a Sunday school. This was later done, through the dedicated work and cooperation of members from Newbury and the Reading Ecclesia, and a good Sunday school and youth group resulted, which led eventually to the removal of the Newbury Ecclesia to Thatcham, where they have now obtained a nice little hall of their own, far more suitable than the old auctioneer's room. So, some permanent good did come of the gospel rally, but by that time we ourselves had moved on.